It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. Hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving holiday. I'll tell you, we had so much food. It was utterly ridiculous. Gluttonous, even, I would say. But I had the unique privilege of having family come in from California, from New York, from really all over the country. And we ended up having about 19 people at the dinner table, which was quite a challenge given the fact that my dining room table typically will handle easily, maybe 8 people. So we had people kind of all over the place. But anyway, I'm sure you've all heard that earlier this week there was a significant decision from the federal courts dealing with the concept of gerrymandering. Now, just as a side note, historical reference, the term gerrymander refers to the 1812 election in Massachusetts, where Governor Gerry, spelled G-E-R-R-Y, not Jerry, but Gerry, was running for re-election. And in the process of attempting to redistrict or redraw the lines for that district area, the resulting pattern resembled a salamander. And the newspapers ended up calling this process gerrymandering. Over the years, it's kind of switched into gerrymandering, I think, just because it's easier to say, rolls off the tongue a little bit easier. But the concept of gerrymandering has to do with trying to obtain an advantage in one particular area by utilizing the fact that there's a process whereby votes can become wasted, the old wasted vote phenomenon. And what that means is that if you're voting in a district that is already deemed to likely go in a particular direction, and if things have been restructured such that your vote just gets lumped in with others that are already of a similar cast, then your vote has less impact. That's the primary method. And then by splitting up districts into different patterns, such as the salamander, you end up giving more strength, usually to an incumbent party, and watering down the votes that would otherwise be challenging it. There's a number of different methods that it's done. One is called the cracking method, where you split apart an apparently strong, sometimes urban area, so that it has more heavily weighted votes coming in from non-urban portions of that same district. Or there's the compression method, whereby votes are more concentrated in order, again, to get that wasted vote effort to come into play. It's a bit of a controversy, of course, because if we use that term gerrymandering, it has a pejorative context. We're talking about something that on its face would appear to be unfair. And sure enough, our federal courts just earlier this week found that the efforts to redistrict here in Wisconsin in virtually all of the districts actually amounted to an unconstitutional manipulation of voting districts. I was a little surprised by the result. I understand the theory behind it, but it appeared to me that that was a pretty high burden. Part of the rationale behind it, however, did have to do with, and this is a little unusual for a constitutional litigation, actually examining what the apparent purpose behind the redrawing of lines was. And that, of course, requires an inference and some guesswork, and very rarely do you see federal courts engaging in that kind of guesswork. But what happened was, in every 10 years, of course, the federal census comes out. And the last one was in 2010. And that's all demographic information about the makeup of different ethnic, socioeconomic groups and other features of potential voters. That data is then used to make a guess as to how voters will likely perform in an upcoming election. And we've got another census occurring in 2020. So that's one reason why the litigation in this matter started when it did, because it's presumed, and I agree with this, that it will probably reach its way to the United States Supreme Court on this issue. And if you do the math, 2016, going into 2017, that leaves just short of 3 years before the next census, and it may very well take that long to get all the way to the Supreme Court. It appears, of course, that the state of Wisconsin, by the Attorney General, is going to appeal that decision and will end up seeing it on its way to the United States Supreme Court. Whether they take the case or not, as you know, is a discretionary matter, but this is something that has significant national impact. Now, let's talk a little bit about whether this is a process that can be controlled and whether or not it's fair. Does it match with our concept of democracy and so forth? One view, and this isn't necessarily incorrect, is that we have never had a democracy where one vote equals one person or one person equals one vote. In that we are a representative democracy. So the grouping of votes is something that is sort of inherent to our system. And you see how that works, for example, with the National Electoral College. What happens, and as we discussed on an earlier show, the Electoral College essentially is designed to make it so the states in and of themselves have the ability to have a stronger voice rather than urban areas versus non-urban areas or population centers having too much control over the outcome based upon pure popularity. And that's built into our Constitution that this is not a majority rules type situation. You know, we've heard a lot of discussion about the possibility of re-examining the Electoral College. That would require changing the Constitution significantly and probably would not work. But as I've mentioned before, one reason why the Electoral College is actually a good idea is that it makes the possibility of voter fraud or, for that matter, illegal campaign activities from having a significant impact on a nationwide basis. But let's look at Ohio and California and New York, Florida, states that have a lot of electorates. Compare that with Idaho that has two. The idea is that each state is given a number of electors that then cast their ballots in accordance with how that state has chosen a particular nominee. So referring back to my concept of wasted votes or the votes that don't count, there are probably a lot of people in Idaho that would vote one way and a lot of people who would vote the other way, but the state ends up becoming, as a whole, voting for a one candidate or the other. And that is designed to give that state standing or sufficient power as a state in comparison with other states. Now, of course, some states have greater populations than others, and that's why we have different numbers of electoral votes. But anyway, getting back to this concept of whether or not gerrymandering or redistricting or changing of the district lines is something that is tolerated within this concept. Let's just remember, of course, that it's not something where one person equals one vote anyway. The apparent purpose behind changing district lines is because there's changes in population concentrations. And when that occurs, it's under the auspices of trying to equalize or spread out the impact of votes. So, you know, redistricting in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just that it can be used in such a way to try and disenfranchise people. So when somebody has a vote to cast and it turns out that because their district is split up, the concept behind the lawsuit had to do with disenfranchisement of that person's voice through a deliberate effort to try and manipulate the voting. So interesting to see what will happen because the both parties have been ordered by the federal courts to come up with a remedy based upon the findings. And one potential remedy, believe it or not, is there could be, I emphasize could be because I doubt it'll happen, but there could be an order for another election, a new one done correctly without the redistricting problems. I'm sure you can imagine the logistics involved with that and how difficult that would be. And it could, in fact, affect the national election. But again, I doubt any of that's going to happen because there's going to be, regardless of the remedy that is ordered by the federal courts, an appeal taken, obviously. And any suggested remedy probably would not have an opportunity to go into effect. Be that as it may, we'll follow the continuing saga of how this matter winds its way through its courts. And we'll be right back after these messages, so please stay tuned.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 1015 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. Did you know that the history of marijuana in our country goes back to before we were a country, back to the colonies? And in fact, many of the colonies were ordered by the king in England and also some of the other vested property interests in the colonies to grow hemp plants. In fact, there was a standing order that every farmer that had a farm capable of doing so was required to maintain 100 hemp plants in order to provide support to the king, because hemp, of course, is a very valuable commodity in the sense that the fibers in the hemp plant are a very strong and resilient source of making rope and other products that require that type of fiber structure. In fact, it's been used to make very durable sacks, sails, binding material, all kinds of things. And the history of it as a plant in our country has obviously been something that Mother Nature preceded any sort of regulation on it. But interestingly, the initial regulations required people to actually grow it. But as we became a country and formed our United States, over time, as a result of the government attempting to regulate various activities, as well as some other events going on in the world, the concept of what we now refer to as controlled substances slowly built momentum, combined with some other aspects of trying to determine what the true effects of marijuana on people as human beings are, it took on this characteristic of being somewhat vilified. We're all familiar with that. In our own lifetimes, we've seen changes in attitudes about it. But going back to the reasons why marijuana became illegal to begin with, it actually started with an effort to deal with the labeling of prescription drugs. And there was a time when you could walk into a pharmacy and walk out with a vial full of laudanum or heroin or cocaine or something like that, and didn't even need a doctor's permission for that. So part of an effort in the late 1800s and early 1900s to have some accountability for the purity or safety, really, of substances that were being distributed. The focus was not so much on the fact that people could die from overdoses or that people could become addicted to these substances. It had more to do with the purity or the actual labeling of things. And this coincided with a national concern about the lack of safety regulations that for all sorts of various products, including food products, canned meat, things like that. And if you're familiar with the novel The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, that was a kind of a turning point in the way that American society started to realize that if you give too much power to those who are interested in making money, they have financial incentives to cut corners, make things cheaper, and not focus on the safety of a particular product. So born out of a an effort to protect the public from adulterated substances, there became a debate about how to treat particular medications that were being distributed. And again, it was really more that when you went to get a bottle of an opiate from the pharmacy, that it was not tainted with mercury or something that else that would kill you, not so much on the abuse part of it. But as the 20th century was well underway, there became efforts to address marijuana in particular. And there was a point in time in our nation's history where marijuana was viewed as the most harmful drug on the planet that exists, more harmful than cocaine, heroin, or anything for that matter. Part of that came from an effort to strengthen the need for some of these safety laws and labeling laws, but also because it was seen as a potential source of revenue that was being lost. Ironic, because that's the same reason why we now have marijuana legalization efforts going on across the country, because it's deemed something where the state itself could make money, combined with the fact that we appear to have come to the conclusion that it is not possible to regulate this conduct as tightly as our former legislators would have hoped. But something very interesting about how there was this shift in public opinion had to do with testimony before Congress on various laws that were being enacted in order to address how these types of substances can be regulated. And if you've ever seen the movie Reefer Madness, not only is it amusing because of its vast inaccuracies, but also the obvious effort to propagandize and vilify marijuana itself to an extreme level. I mean, it's why it's comical now, because you realize that they say things like, marijuana drives people insane, it permanently changes your brain and turns you into a homicidal maniac. Things that were being said in all sincerity back in the 1920s, 1930s, and so on. And at the time, marijuana use was strongly associated with both Mexicans and African-Americans as sort of a stereotype. You know, at the dawn of the jazz age, you pictured these New Orleans-style ragtime bands with a bunch of pot-smoking Negroes. That was kind of how people viewed the marijuana thing. Or the swarthy Mexican that came across the border with smoking these Mexican cigarettes and so forth. But that attitude was channeled into efforts to make it so the government had the power to have more regulation on this type of issue, as well as others that had to do with controlled substances. So up until that time, for those of you that know how the balance of state power versus federal power is supposed to work, controlled substances were not seen as a federal issue, because it should, and probably still should, fall within the individual states to make their own determinations regarding how the quality of life or the laws that make things legal or illegal in their particular jurisdictions should operate. Because after all, the federal government is supposed to be limited in its power. It's not supposed to have overarching power. But again, because of these labeling and purity acts that were coming through at the time, it was seen as a national problem because it was a health issue. And if you were going to get a tainted tin of meat that wasn't very carefully packaged and salmonella's in there or whatever sorts of organisms that could harm you, well, since those cans of meat were being shipped across state lines, the federal government thought it was important to protect the entire nation as a whole. Now, as we just saw in this last election, the largest number of states simultaneously ever in our history considered voter initiatives, ballot initiatives, to re-examine whether or not recreational marijuana should be legalized in those states, partly in response to the fact that Colorado, Oregon, I think New Mexico, a couple of other states have gone down the path, and now it looks like California is going to be one of those, of deregulation of this as a dangerous substance, but re-regulation of it as a potential revenue builder. It's been an argument that's been out there for many, many years that if you can't stop people from using marijuana, you might as well make money off of it. And not a bad idea, because a lot of these states are actually funneling that money into resources that we have dramatically underfunded, or we've relied solely on general taxpayer dollars. And I mean specifically educational programs, road projects, funding of all manner of public good, you know, maintaining our parks, things like that. So rather than having the money come from all of us, let's make sure that marijuana is regulated by the government and that there is a tax that can be collected, just like when you buy a bottle of beer or a pack of cigarettes or whatever it is, or a gallon of gas, because it's more like a use tax or a tax that's added on to funding those particular issues. And you know what? For those that do believe that marijuana is a gateway drug, which has been basically scientifically debunked, but if you think that it's still a bad thing, and I'm not saying it's a good thing, but you know, some of that money can be funneled into drug education in our schools, something better than the DARE program, which was deemed a failure because it actually resulted in a higher incidence of drug use among youth, and have more effective means of dealing with some of our social problems. All of that requires more money, as we know, and if the general public isn't willing to fund those things, let's get it straight out of the marijuana. So we have to take a break right now, but we'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. In the studio with me this morning is actually my mother, Dr. O'Bear, who's visiting from New York. She popped in the WHBL mobile studio this morning. And, well, during the break, while you were listening to those fancy commercials, we were just talking about how, you know, this gateway drug issue. Because she was overhearing, you know, part of the stuff that I was talking about. See what a great fan base I have? I have people coming from other states to come watch me record the show. Isn't that fascinating? So Dr. O'Bear over here, seated to my left, was just telling me how the medical community has ways of dealing with this gateway drug concept. And she makes a good point. And, you know, maybe marijuana is a gateway behavior, not a gateway drug. Well, there are people that say it shouldn't be called a drug at all. I mean, it's like, you know, can you call oregano a drug? Well, yeah, but it doesn't really have psychoactive effects. But caffeine's a drug, right? Do we call caffeine a drug? No, we call it an additive to our sodas or a naturally occurring substance in our coffee. But she makes a good point, and that is that a lot of the reasons why people end up transmitting their desire to escape reality from marijuana onto other harder drugs, it's more of a behavioral medical, psychological issue than it is marijuana turning somebody into a drug addict. Is it true that when someone is attempting to alter their consciousness by using marijuana that they might be prone to do so with other controlled substances and other bad things? Of course. Of course it is. But that's like saying if you play video games, then you are, you know, a lesser person of lesser intelligence because you prefer this alternate reality to the reality. And there's some merit to that as well, because when people get addicted to ultraviolet games, I suppose you can draw a connection to how they behave in the world. But most of us are capable of going on an Xbox and playing some games and then separating that from what you really do in life. It's like reading a book. We have not had a problem with alternate realities in romance novels or historical fiction or futuristic novels. Those things aren't gateways to more dangerous behavior because we trust people to be able to regulate their own conduct. I mean, think about it. You live in the world with the responsibility of doing right things and not doing wrong things, and it's up to you. The criminal laws our guidance for you. It gives you structure. It gives you a way of knowing what you already know, by the way. If we didn't have a law that made it so it's illegal to kill people, well, I suppose there wouldn't be that same deterrent effect, but you know it's not right. You know, it's not the right thing to do. And you make personal choices about your life every day. And that's something that America has always held to be extremely important. Self-determination. Make the most of what you get. In fact, that's the heart of capitalism. You see what I'm saying? So marijuana is just like capitalism. If you can make something happen based on your own willpower, the strength that you have within, and avoiding those weaknesses that make you weaker or less effective, more power to you, because then you become successful. So these choices that you have to make in life, like what you're going to do today, are you going to go to the gym and improve your health? Are you going to go eat 7 cheeseburgers and damage your health? You know, we really don't have laws that say you can or can't do those things. It's up to you. It's up to you to make those choices. And I will tell you, as we have become more and more willing to acknowledge over the years, there is a large number of responsible adults who regularly utilize marijuana because of its psychoactive effects, naturally, in order to achieve the benefit of that. And there are people that, you know, you're surrounded by them in your community. You may not know who they are because it's still somewhat of a secret, but, you know, it's not something that you can do openly, at least not now. And, but it is something that many people derive a benefit from, much like having a glass of wine at the end of the day. And ultimately, I think the fact that we've been so afraid of this issue is something that we're going to eventually overcome. As I was mentioning in the last segment, we have the potential in this country to benefit greatly, you know, financially, from all of this. And if we stop trying to funnel all of our money into suppressing something that I think we have to acknowledge simply cannot effectively be suppressed at this point, we need to reevaluate it. So we're seeing it happen all over the country. Perhaps we'll see it here. I want to switch gears a little bit because there was a pretty significant development. It's been going on over the past couple months, and it has to do with jury instructions and how they work in the criminal justice system. If you've ever been a juror in a jury trial, you have heard before things get started, the judge will give a list of, we call them instructions, and they're pre-written down. If it looks like the judge is reading off of a script, that's because he or she is. It's actually a script in the sense that it's predetermined words that have been deemed to be legally appropriate and not giving too much of a benefit to one side or the other. There are civil instructions for civil cases where people are suing each other or trying to seek an injunction. And then there are criminal instructions that deal with the burdens of proof, how the elements of an offense are defined, and how the overall structure of a trial should work. You know, it's interesting. Back when I was a JAG in the United States Air Force, and by the way, JAG stands for Judge Advocate General. I don't know. Sometimes people think it stands for something else. But and technically, you're not a JAG. You're a member of the Judge Advocate General's department. Another little misnomer that's out there. But I started off as a prosecutor at Scott Air Force Base, and they have it even more regulated in terms of how it works. And I remember we'd have these courts-martial where you bring in quote-unquote jurors. They're basically officers, and if the defendant is an enlisted person, you can have some enlisted people also on the jury panel. And especially those that had not participated in any such event previously, everybody thought it was really weird because everybody's reading out of a book at them, but you also appear to be talking to the person, like, good morning, my name is Captain O'Bear, next line. And they'd sort of look at you like, why are you reading out of a book? That's really weird. Aren't you just supposed to be talking to us? Well, you have to remember that the things that can be predetermined in the interest of fairness and in the interest of making sure that a trial complies with the law, there is something, an entity known as the Jury Instruction Committee. And in a general sense, it is people that are, I think, somewhat arbitrarily deemed to know enough about the law to tell uneducated jurors what the law should be. And if that sounds a little offensive, it probably should be, because the assumption is that jurors can't figure this stuff out on their own, and they need some highfalutin lawyers someplace to figure it out for them and tell them in such a way that their brains can understand. So yeah, that is kind of presumptuous that jurors can't figure it out. On the other hand, if you just had a trial with no guidance and you just threw people into a room and said, let us know what you figure out, there may be some struggle in terms of how to arrive at that process. But for many, many years, and I mean like half a century, we've had a growing concern about how to define the concept of reasonable doubt. Reasonable doubt is the heart and soul of the criminal justice system in the sense that it is the highest burden that exists anywhere in the world. There is no court that requires proof beyond all doubt, and there is no court that in the world that has a burden as high as that, meaning reasonable doubt, before a conviction can be achieved. The idea being that it is not a fair balance of power. It is not supposed to be who has 51% of the available evidence or convincing power behind that evidence, but that the burden falls squarely on the prosecution always and never shifts to the defense. Do you know why? Because it has to do with protecting all of those rights that are enumerated in the Bill of Rights and other rights that are created within our statutes in order to make sure the best we can that innocent people don't get convicted. I say that with a bit of a giggle, and it's not funny, but innocent people do get convicted all the time. As we know, it's borne out by examples of cases that have gone awry. But the lawyers get together on this jury instruction committee. It consists of prosecutors, judges. Occasionally, they invite a defense lawyer, too, just to see if there's anything that they have to say. And they sit in a room and they talk about, well, I think this would be the best way to word it. And somebody else says, no, I think this would be the best way to word it. And they sit there and argue and then eventually come to a conclusion about how a judge is supposed to instruct a jury. That has to do not only with procedural aspects of the case, but the substantive part, too, like an estimation of what we think the legislature meant when they said this is a particular crime and these are the elements that the state must prove. And by the way, that process isn't spelled out in most statutes. Let's say, for example, disorderly conduct. I'll get to that right when we come back after these messages. But in the meantime, please listen to our sponsors and partake in whatever services or products they offer. We'll be right back.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back, listeners. Kirk O'Bear, this is Legal Defense. Just before the break, we were talking about the process whereby a statute enacted by the legislature turns into a trial issue and how the jury instruction committee breaks down the elements of that offense. And I was starting to talk about how disorderly conduct is a good example. If you look up the statute, it says disorderly conduct is against the law. And it says if you engage in disorderly conduct, it is a particular class of misdemeanor. It's actually an unclassified misdemeanor, which by default means that you can get 90 days in jail or pay a $1,000 fine or both. But the legislature didn't really do a very good job of defining what disorderly conduct is. And there was an old saying when I was in the Air Force, because they have a general article, Article 125, that if you can't find it somewhere else in the statute books, make it up as you go, and you'll know it when you see it, kind of like obscenity. You can't really describe what obscenity is, but you know it when you see it. if it has that effect on you where you're like, ew, well, that's obscenity right there. But disorderly conduct can include anything that's loud, boisterous, profane, obscene. And then there's this little definition in there that says, or otherwise disorderly. So we used to say the elements of something like that under the general article in the Uniform Code of Military Justice was element one, you did something. Element two, somebody else didn't like it. And that's about it. So, but how we go through the process of making sure that it is a crime, first of all, and that juries are told what those elements are. Elements are like ingredients in a recipe. So if you were going to have a recipe for a chocolate cake, you'd have to have eggs, flour, butter, sugar, and chocolate. If you're missing the chocolate, you can't call it a chocolate cake, can you? Because it doesn't have the chocolate. So if a piece of the puzzle is missing and the jury can't find the evidence of that piece, that means not guilty. That's how it's supposed to work. But I started this whole discussion because there is this concept of, quote unquote, searching for the truth that is included in the reasonable doubt jury instruction. You know, if you were to try and define what reasonable doubt really is, yes, you could probably adopt the language I just used earlier, which is the highest burden that exists in the world. By the way, that's not part of the instruction. You could say it is proof that convinces you beyond other reasonable hypotheses that might be drawn from the same evidence. Well, that's a little complicated. You could also say that it is a burden that falls squarely on the prosecution, never shifts the defense, and you can't view any efforts or lack thereof from the defense as contributing to that burden of proof. That's a little complicated too. So what the jury instruction committee did is they used this language that says you're not supposed to search for doubt. You're supposed to search for the truth. In honestly, and I'll give them credit, by trying to use words that are not technical, not legal in nature, and trying to explain exactly how that process should work. Well, another way of putting that, if you can use kind of an example, if the government were to present evidence of a bank robbery and they established that the bank was in fact a bank, and if they were to establish that someone walked in, the defendant, carrying a gun, presented a note, said, "Give me all your money, I'm robbing you," and then they had witnesses that testified to that. They produced the note that says, "Give me all your money." They confiscate the gun. They have the picture from surveillance. And then they have the guy that gets caught admitting that he did it. Well, those are all pieces of evidence that would be admitted in order for the government to meet its burden of proof. And what this instruction that says, don't search for doubt, search for the truth, what they really mean by that is, don't ignore the evidence of guilt in the process of trying to come up with your own possibilities in your own mind. In other words, you don't hypothetically say, well, this could have been a vast conspiracy that the government planted that photo from the surveillance. And maybe there was somebody that looked exactly like this guy that did it. And maybe when he confessed to it, he was in an alternate fugue state and was confused. I mean, that's what they're saying is don't make stuff up in your own mind to make the burden higher than it actually is. And that makes sense. So in other words, aliens didn't beam down and commit this crime, and the government failed to prove that that's not what happened. You know, that's not what they're saying. And in the process of trying to focus juries on examining the evidence, this language, unfortunately, because of the way it's worded, makes it appear that the burden really isn't as high as it should be. But again, we don't have a dictionary definition of beyond a reasonable doubt. It doesn't exist. There's case law that says it's hard to define and you can't really put it into, it's a concept. And the concept really means the burden is there and that it's a high one. So if someone were to say to you, don't search for doubt, but you still have to consider reasonable doubt and you still have to consider any doubt that is in fact, quote unquote, reasonable, and you are supposed to consider hypotheticals, which you are, the point is that it should arise from the evidence. But when you tell jurors not to search for doubt and search for the truth, it tends to, I mean, we've always believed that it tends to have this effect on jurors where they think, well, if I'm searching for the truth, that means I'm supposed to rely more on a hunch, rely more on how this feels. It should, you know, what do I guess happened here? Because nobody knows exactly what the truth is. And if they say to you, hey, you know, if you walk down the street and encounter somebody and say, hey, tell me something that you know to be true. It could be something obvious, but it could also be something like, you know, a doomsday prepper who's like, well, you know, the world's going to end in 3 days. Do they believe it to be true? Probably. But that's not the point. When you talk about truth, it really kind of goes past what we're trying to accomplish in a trial. And that seems odd because we should be searching for the truth, but we all know it's an imperfect system. And the focus should always be not did the person commit the crime, but can the government prove that the person committed the crime? That's always been the essence of our criminal justice system. And people need to remember that when they're coming in. So there has been, believe it or not, an effort to gather statistical information about the effect of those words. And what happened was there was a group of mock or moot trials or fake trials that were conducted as part of a research project. Identical facts were presented to different juries. Some juries received this instruction, you are not to search for the truth, you're not to search for doubt, you're to search for the truth. Other jurors did not hear that specific phrase. Here's what you may find surprising. There was a significantly higher conviction rate on the same facts presented in the same way to different types of juries when they received this instruction. This was done in the context of a case that was not, you know, the facts that were presented were not necessarily clear-cut. There was the possibility of reasonable doubt raised by those facts. And it's significant now because there is actual statistical data that backs up what I've suspected for years, is that when you tell the jury to search for the truth, sounds like a good thing, right? That they are more inclined to convict somebody when you leave that language out, which begs the question, if you leave the language out, are you helping the defense? Are you making it more difficult for the prosecution? Absolutely not. Because there's no doubt, and there shouldn't be any doubt in jurors' minds, that their job is to scrutinize the evidence and that it's the prosecution's job to do that. So this is language that's actually used all over the country. And you know what else is funny? Nobody knows where it came from. It's been in the jury instructions for various different states for a very long time. And the best estimate as to how it got there was that there was, a DA's organization or a group of people that didn't like the fact that occasionally they lose a trial. And they went down the path of this concept of what we call equalization of the party's opportunities to litigate. And the reason why that is a bit incongruous with how the system should work is, and you hear this from prosecutors all the time, they say, Judge, I'm just looking for a fair trial. Well, really, the concept of fair really only applies to the judge making sure that the defendant gets a fair trial. Of course, the government has the opportunity and should conform with the law. The judge shouldn't hamper them unnecessarily, but it's not supposed to be a level playing field. It never is. If you hear that, and you see a lot in Law and Order where the DA's in there talking to the judge, he says, this isn't fair to the state. If they're going to be able to do this, we want to be able to do that. Unfortunately, that is a concept and a train of thought that's actually very dangerous for our justice system. And it's something that has in the past contributed to convictions that should not have occurred and innocent people being convicted. You have to ask, this little phrase that consists of two sentences, has that had an impact over the course of many, many years of unnecessarily and improperly convicting people? It'll be interesting to see where it goes from here because there's actually a strong incentive now for us to re-examine whether or not that language makes sense. Well, it's been fun, enjoyable, rewarding, and entertaining spending a Saturday morning with all y'all. So I hope you have a great weekend. Go Pack Go. And tune in next week to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear. Have a great weekend.